The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to get started here in just a second.
I'm Vice President of the Law and Government Society, and we're co-sponsoring this event with the LLM Program on Law and Government. We've got a really great panel today, and we're happy to be joined by Professor Vermeil, Robin, and Jones, as well as Dean Niles. We'll be here shortly, theoretically.
Hopefully.
And Professor Vermeil will moderate the action here and give a little better introduction of each of the professors who joined us today. In a sec, I'm just going to pass out an email sign-up sheet as well for the Law and Government Society, so that even if you've signed up in the past, there's been some email snafus, so if you can get your email addresses again, so we can keep you abreast of upcoming events, one of which we have next Thursday, the 28th, that we're co-sponsoring with the Federal Bar Association on the legislative process, and there's going to be a speaker from the Hill there as well, and we will... There'll be more emails and advertising forthcoming on that next week. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Vermeil, and I'm going to pass out the sheets, and you guys can sign up during the action. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Peter. We've been doing this for, I called it the 8th annual. I actually made that up. But I think we've been doing it for at least 8 years. It could be the 9th annual or the 7th annual. You won't hold me to that. And it's always a lot of fun to do this with the Program on Law and Government, which is a law school, wide program, and the Law and Government Society, which is a student-run organization. We all try to put on interesting programming for you and always appreciate that, people come and take advantage of it, hopefully not just take advantage of the pizza, but also take advantage of the programming. And I also would like to thank the Office of Special Events and CLE, which does a great job helping with arrangements for these events, and did so again today. At this point, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear about 29 cases for the term that begins on October 2nd. The court has room for about 77 cases. So we've got 29 slotted out of what eventually will probably be 77. The court beginning next week and then in ensuing weeks will begin filling in those additional slots for oral arguments. And obviously we can't really predict what else the court will decide to hear in the future. So our focus today is to pick out a few of those 29 cases that they've already agreed to hear and try to introduce you to a little bit about those cases and the issues involved. We're really only going to talk about 8 or 10. They're not the only 8 or 10 that are interesting or important. If we tried to do all of them, we'd have to ask you to stay here for 3 hours and I think the pizza would run out before then, and you probably would have other things to do. So we're really going to focus on some of the ones that we thought were most interesting. Let me mention a couple that we're not going to focus on today. There are a couple of very interesting and important patent cases. If you're interested in IP law, they are somewhat hard to describe, would have taken a lot of time, but they are quite significant. I think the intellectual property program here and the clinic will be doing some programming on those cases in the near future, and that's one reason why we didn't focus on them. There are also two really important and interesting environmental law cases, and I understand that the Environmental Law Society here at WCL has a very good friend of mine, Professor Richard Lazarus from Georgetown Law School, coming to speak about those cases. Is it next week?
Okay.
Week from tomorrow. And so that's another reason why we chose not to do those, is because there's already some programming taking place on those cases. But they are really interesting and important cases, and Professor Lazarus is a terrific speaker and professor, and so I urge you to look for announcements about that. So what we are going to do is the four of us are each going to talk about different areas, and I don't want to take more time with introductions. I want to get right to it. We're going to start with Professor Cynthia Jones, who's on my far right, and then go to Professor Ira Robbins, who's next to her. And then I'm going to present a couple of cases, and then we'll come to Professor Niles after that. And so without further ado, let's turn to Professor Jones.
Thank you. I'm going to talk about two cases. My area of practice and work is in the area of criminal law, criminal procedure, evidence, and wrongful conviction. And the first case is Wallace versus City of Chicago. Wallace versus City of Chicago is an interesting case because it's a wrongful conviction case. Mr. Wallace was arrested by the police based upon an uncorroborated informant's tip. And those of you who've had criminal procedure know the Supreme Court has held many years ago that if you're going to rely on an informant tip, you have to have some additional information to corroborate it. That is, a reason to believe it's accurate before you have probable cause to arrest. Nonetheless, Mr. Wallace was arrested on an uncorroborated informant tip, and then after an all-night interrogation session, he confessed to a murder and was convicted based in large part on his confession. The Supreme Court is reviewing this case because there's a conflict among the various circuit courts as to when the statute of limitations begins to run on a Fourth Amendment claim. After 8 years in prison, Mr. Wallace was released when the higher court in Illinois held that his arrest was unlawful, that is, they violated his Fourth Amendment rights because there was not probable cause to arrest him, and eventually held that the confession that they got out of him was also suppressed or inadmissible evidence. It was a product of his unlawful arrest. And so as a result, the government had no evidence to proceed against him because the case was built largely on his confession, which he claims was coerced and false. After the government dismissed the case, Mr. Wallace was released from prison, and a year later, he filed an action against the City of Chicago and the police officers who he claimed falsely arrested him and coerced a confession from him. And the court held that he waited too long, that his claim, the 2-year statute of limitations for bringing this claim, began to run either when he was falsely arrested in 1994, it's now 2003 when he brings this action, or the 2-year statute of limitations began to run in 1998 when the lower court held that he had been falsely arrested. Again, at the latest the court held, by 2000, his claim expired. He could no longer sue the city for false arrest or for the other constitutional violation. The Seventh Circuit and other circuit courts around the country differ as to when a statute of limitations begins to run on a Fourth Amendment violation for false arrest. Mr. Wallace and his lawyers contend that it does not begin to run until he was released from prison, after the court found that his confession was false, that his arrest was unconstitutional. At that point, he then, the 2-year statute of limitations began to run. So when he was released in 2002, and filed his action in 2003, he was within the statute of limitations. This case is going to be interesting in the wrongful convictions context because a lot of people who are exonerated.
And it takes a while to find counsel. And filing these claims while you are a prisoner and allow the law to unclear whether you've been wrongly convicted or before the DNA has come in, it will result in lots of prisoners never being able to seek monetary damages for civil action once they have been exonerated. And it's clear that they've been wrongly convicted along their last book. So Wallace v. City of Chicago will have interesting repercussions beyond Mr. Wallace's case. And the court took the case essentially to resolve the conflict among the circuit courts as to when the statute of limitations begins to run in Fourth Amendment wrongful arrest case. The second case is Orton versus Botting, B-O-T-A-T-I-N-G. Mr. Orton was convicted in Nevada of raping his 6-year-old daughter. And after the inappropriate sexual contact occurred, she made statements to her mother, saying, you know, that he raped her, and then the mother goes to the hospital, and the little girl then made statements to a police officer saying that he raped her. But by the time of the preliminary hearing, when the suspect was charged, the the little girl would not stay. Again, she would not believe what happened. And she began to contradict herself, and eventually she did say nothing happened. Well, the government still wanted to proceed with the prosecution, and the government called at trial the mother who testified when the little girl told her, and the police officer who testified when the little girl told him. The problem is, both of those cases are out-of-court cases made by the little girl, just hearsay. And hearsay is allowed in trials, and this is one of the exceptions under the hearsay rule for reliable testimony. The other issue, other hurdle that hearsay testimony has to overcome in criminal cases is the confrontation law. The Supreme Court in a case called Crawford v. Washington, a landmark case decided in 2004, said that in order to get in hearsay, out-of-court statements in a criminal case, they have to be testimonial in nature, non-testimonial in nature. The defendant has to have had a previous opportunity to cross-examine the person who makes the statement. The problem here is under the Confrontation Clause, you have a right to confront a witness who has had opportunity to put them to the test of their testimony, and you don't have the chance to do that if the witnesses aren't there. The mother's there, the police officer's there, the little girl's not there, and she can't be cross-examined. Of course, in some circumstances, that will violate your confrontation clause rights, and therefore those kinds of hearsay statements, even if they're reliable, the little girl made an excited utterance to hunting and forms of a positive event, she's talking to the officer and the mother, that would normally come in, but because the defendant doesn't have an opportunity to cross-examine that statement, it would not come in. Well, the important front of blocking, the court has to decide the retroactivity of that Crawford rule. Because when this report was convicted, Crawford had not yet been decided. And the confrontation clause was not a barrier to the local cases coming in through the police officer and through her mother at that time. However, while this court was appealing his conviction on a collateral attack on the condition of the federal court, while that federal appeal was pending, the court heard that Crawford v. Washington case was decided. And the Ninth Circuit said, well, we're going to apply the Crawford rule. We believe that it should be retroactive. The appeal is still alive at the time. We're going to apply the Crawford rule. And if you apply Crawford, you do that. The little girl's statement should never have come in because of a more testimonial nature, and he did not have the opportunity at a previous preliminary hearing or at an earlier trial to cross-examine the child, and therefore admitting the child's statement violates his right to confrontation. And the issue becomes some circuit court will get them, that some circuit court has held that Crawford is not to be applied retroactively, and other circuit courts have held that it is to be applied retroactively. And the Supreme Court has to decide in which circuit is Crawford. It's reckoned that it becomes such a landmark, watershed change in the law that it will be applied retroactively, or alternatively, but a simple change in the rule that it doesn't mean that every single case that was pending collateral review at the time will get the benefit of the Crawford rule. So it may very well be what the Supreme Court says Crawford applies prospectively, and therefore the court, although that testimony will not have come in any trial, should have the benefit of that rule. Or the court may apply it retroactively to governing this, but it has huge repercussions because statements that would violate Crawford were routinely admitted in criminal cases, most frequently in child sex cases, and a lot of times in domestic violence cases. So usually the battered wife calls 911 and says, "Help me, my husband's beating me," and then by the time of trial, she doesn't want to testify anymore, get reconciled, or she's so scared she doesn't testify. The government wants to use the wife's 911 recorded statement and play that for the jury at trial. The defendant says, "I never had a chance to use my son to elicit that statement. My wife, she's not being called as a witness. She'd be able to use that statement against me." And under some circumstances, the court has held that would violate the confrontation clause under some circumstances. So depending on the retroactivity of the rule in Crawford, Ms. Horton and other similarly situated defendants may benefit alternatively and will probably support the rule that Crawford only applies to those vaccinated in cases decided after Crawford, and they're not going to go back to the city. Those kinds of things that came in the cases that were decided before Crawford.
Chief, they want to give you the game plan again. The other three of us also have presentations to make about cases. My hope is that we will get all that done substantially before 1 o'clock. I love potential 1 at the time. We ask questions. If there aren't questions, we may add more cases to talk about. But I'd like to have all the presentations done before people have to start leaving and people will address questions. So, good.
But that's only because every year I expect you're not going to remember. I'm going to talk about the rhythm of being disclosed. I don't want to persuade you. I don't feel I have to persuade you. Previous corpus issues which didn't overlap with death penalty issues. Those of you who aren't aware of it, the writ of habeas corpus was a common law and a statute for a writ on a state, another state, but also a federal prison can to get resentenced or to get out of prison or to get off death row if they have been convicted and or sentenced in violation of the federal constitution. There are many scholars who say that habeas corpus is the most important human right in the Constitution because, she was talking about substantive constitutional criminal law matters. Without a writ of habeas corpus, these matters don't have access to the court. Habeas corpus is the vehicle that allows the court to be in violation of many other provisions of the Bill of Rights. I'm going to start by presenting some context for you. In the last few years, the Supreme Court has had an extraordinary number of habeas corpus cases on its relatively small docket of 75 to 85 or so cases. In 2002, of the court's docket, they had 11 habeas cases. 2003, 17. Last year, 2004, 13. Last year, another 7 cases. That's 48 habeas cases in 4 years. In the heyday of the writ of habeas corpus, which basically is 1963 through middle of 1970s, maybe they would have one habeas case a year, maybe 3 habeas cases every 2 years. There has never been a decade in which they have had as many as 48 or 38 or even 28 cases. And this year, we have 6 more, so that's 54 habeas cases, or 6 more so far this year, 6 of the 29 that have been accepted, 54 habeas cases in 5 years. That's astounding. Many people, I would say, including some who should know better, think that the Supreme Court gets involved in habeas corpus only in terrorism situations. And that couldn't be further from the truth. Maybe it's the terrorism situations that make the front page of the major newspapers. But of these 48 cases, or the 54 if we count this year, we only have 4 terrorism cases. The Hamdan case from this year, and from 2004, Padilla, Hamdi, and Razul in that order. So most often habeas corpus is about less publicized issues, less publicized prisoners, but the issues affect many more. The issues affect hundreds and often thousands and sometimes tens of thousands of otherwise unnamed individuals now sitting in prison. One case from early this year, which I won't describe, Hill v. McDonough was a very important case that's now playing out in many of the death penalty states, a habeas case dealing with the lethal injection protocols in the death penalty and the combination of drugs. What made the front pages was the lethal injection issue, but really underneath it was a habeas corpus case. So we might speculate, why is the Supreme Court so fascinated in the last 5 years or so with habeas corpus? And I think there are 2 reasons, or at least I can think of 2 reasons, probably there are others. One is that in 1996, Congress passed and the President signed, President Clinton signed,
a habeas corpus reform bill awkwardly worded the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. That act had probably has some 120 important provisions. I would say 115 of them still have not been interpreted by the Supreme Court. And now they're starting to take a cue from the circuits that the circuits need guidance and the Supreme Court had better provide it. We're seeing a lot of circuit splits, and now the court is stepping in, hopefully to resolve them with some clarity. But just because the court steps in doesn't mean we're necessarily getting that clarity or any guidance whatsoever. The second reason, I think, for the Supreme Court's fascination with death penalty is that the court is fed up. What are they fed up with? They are fed up with circuits like the Fourth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit that have turned a blind eye toward providing justice when justice is clearly warranted in death penalty cases. The Supreme Court is certainly no beacon of liberalism, as you know, so it takes a lot for them to get fed up. But when you look at the cases that comprise the Fourth and Fifth Circuits, we're talking about from west to east and then north, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia, also known in capital punishment jargon as the death belt. And when we have in those states very conservative state courts with very conservative federal courts reviewing those state court decisions and routinely not granting relief when relief often is clearly warranted, the Supreme Court is saying we have to look more closely at these cases, and particularly the cases that are coming out of Texas and Virginia. So many of these habeas cases are habeas death cases coming from those two jurisdictions. Now, as I said, the Supreme Court this year has six habeas cases. Professor Jones mentioned two of them, the Wallace case and the Wharton v. Bochtin case. Wharton v. Bochtin is on retroactivity. They have two other retroactivity cases this year, Burton v. Waddington, a really interesting case that I probably need a half hour to set up, so I won't, but really has to do with, well, unless we skip Professor Niles. Yeah, okay, that's a good idea.
Well, let's do that in.
Well, we'll see what we can do about it. Okay, so I'm not going to, but basically it has to do with the retroactivity of a case that turns the federal sentencing guidelines on its head. And if that is upheld and made retroactive, it could clearly apply to approximately a quarter million cases now in the system, which is an argument against doing it, but if the egregiousness of the violation is off the charts, it's still a possibility. And there's another retroactivity case called Ornasky v. Belmontes regarding mitigation evidence in a death penalty case. Now, these are three retroactivity cases. I just want to say in a minute or so why retroactivity as an issue is so important. And here we have three of the six cases this year on retroactivity. Let's say we have a defendant convicted and sentenced in 1995 under procedures that were constitutional at that time. 5 years later, in 2000, the Supreme Court, let's say, it doesn't often happen, but the Supreme Court gives us a decision expanding defendants' rights so that from that point on, prisoners cannot be convicted and or sentenced with that particular violation. So it may be that we have people now sitting in prison, state or federal prison, who have been convicted under tactics, strategies, procedures, decisions that we now say are unconstitutional. Does that make sense? Well, the retroactivity issue helps to create a dialogue, an ongoing dialogue, almost for enlightened justice, so that as we get new rights under the Bill of Rights or new interpretation creating new rights, we would make them retroactive so we don't have people convicted before those things became right, now sitting in state and federal prison. The Supreme Court in 1989 gave us a decision, Teague v. Lane, that basically gave rise to the new retroactivity doctrine. If I were a betting man on these three retroactivity cases now before the Supreme Court, footnote, I am a betting man, I would say the chance of this, of these rights being recognized by the Supreme Court retroactively are slim, because since 1989, the Supreme Court has had 25 cases on retroactivity, and they've only held that one thing was retroactive. Now, there are some exceptions. There's something known as the criminal procedure exception on the retroactivity issue. The Supreme Court has had 22 occasions to declare a case to have come within that exception. And in zero out of 22 cases have they done so. So I think the outcome of these cases is a fair bet. The three other cases, only one of which I'll talk about, Lawrence v. Florida, dealing with statute of limitations under the under this 1996 Anti-Terrorism Act, basically state prisoners, after their state review process is over, have 1 year to get into federal court in order to have habeas corpus review of their state court conviction and sentence. Lawrence v. Florida deals with when and whether that 1 year statute of limitations can be told. It's a really interesting issue, and I could take another half hour on that one, but I won't. Wallace v. Chicago, a habeas case that Professor Jones mentioned, dealing with false arrest and search and seizure. And one other, the sixth that I'm going to talk about, a case called Carey against Musladin, which is really an intellectually interesting case, although you wouldn't know it from the way the cert question was worded. I'm going to give you the cert question here. In the absence of controlling Supreme Court law, did the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit exceed its authority under 28 U.S. Code 2254-D1 by overturning respondent's state conviction of murder on the ground that the courtroom spectators included three family members of the victim who wore a button depicting the deceased? That's the question. And apart from the button issue, it sounds pretty boring. What makes the case intellectually interesting, however, is the reference to 28 U.S. Code 2254-D1, one of the provisions that was enacted in 1996. And I'm going to read that provision, similarly boring. An application for a writ of habeas corpus on behalf of a person in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court shall not be granted. Habeas corpus, federal habeas corpus, federal review of state conviction shall not be granted with respect to any claim that was adjudicated on the merits in state court proceeding, unless the adjudication of the claim resulted in a decision that was contrary to or involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. What does that mean? That's what this case is all about. For present purposes, meaning for my discussion in the next 2 minutes, this case really comes down to whether the California state court unreasonably applied federal law in this criminal case. But what does that mean, to unreasonably apply federal law? Since 2000, the Supreme Court has had 12 cases dealing with interpretation of those words alone, unreasonable application of federal law. Now, why would they need 12 cases to tell us what that means? You think you could do it in one? They haven't done it in 12, and now we have a 13th. The closest we come to getting guidance from the Supreme Court is from a 2000 case in which Justice O'Connor, for the 5-4 majority, said the following. The most important point is that an unreasonable application of federal law is different from an incorrect application of federal law. Now, that just sounds bizarre. In other words, what Carey against Musladin is all about is that the Supreme Court will be deciding not whether the California state court's decision was wrong, but whether it was unreasonably wrong. If the state court decision was incorrect, but not unreasonably incorrect, then the prisoner gets no relief. Only if the state court decision was incorrect and reasonably so will the constitutional violation be remedied. That's the issue in Carey against Musladin. It seems to me predictable that the prisoner is going to lose for reasons I've already mentioned, but also because this case comes from the Ninth Circuit, which is also known as the United States Court of Appeals that gets reversed. the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit last term was reversed 75% of the time. That was a great year for the Ninth Circuit. If you look back a couple of years, they had 1 year with a 90% reversal rate. If it was 1 year, I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, when the Supreme Court's 85 or 86 cases, 36 of them were from the Ninth Circuit, and the Supreme Court reversed in 33 of them. So 75% isn't too bad. So welcome to the world of habeas corpus. There are more than 100 provisions that are crying out for review. We're not getting it on all of the provisions or all of the important provisions. We're getting it selectively. Of the six cases this year, three of them are retroactivity cases. Retroactivity isn't even an issue that comes from the 1996 Act. Retroactivity is from old habeas law. That's still good. So how are these cases going to come out? Answer, in two words, it depends. And what does it depend on? Also, in two words, Justice Kennedy. Justice O'Kennedy is the new Justice O'Connor. He is right at the center of the court. A prisoner cannot win in any of these habeas cases without getting Justice Kennedy's vote. I'll stop here. Thank you.
All right. Professor Nye. I have one case, and I'm going to try to do it quickly so that we'll have time for Steve's many cases and questions. The case I have is Philip Morris versus Mayola Williams, which is actually a punitive damages case. And it's kind of a third in a trilogy of recent punitive damages cases, starting with a case called BMW of North America versus Gore in 1996, and more recently and perhaps more sort of relevantly for this case, State Farm versus Campbell, which was 2003. That case got a fair amount of press coverage. It was an interesting case. State Farm had represented a client of theirs, someone who had bought car insurance with them, who had assumed apparently falsely that by paying all that money for car insurance, that State Farm was actually going to help them out if they got into a car accident. They got into a car accident. State Farm rejected many offers, settlement offers, before trial that would have been within the coverage amount of the insurance policy, thereby avoiding having to pay the amount. Went to trial, lost, promised the people, the plaintiffs, that they wouldn't be liable personally for the damages, and then, of course, refused to pay anything on the amount that was done in the case. And they, strangely enough, decided to sue State Farm under those circumstances, won a significant compensatory award and then a huge, colossal punitive damage award. I think it was $145 million, something like that. And that led to a challenge to that award in the Supreme Court. And in the State Farm case, the Supreme Court handed down, it sort of reaffirmed some standards in the BMW case and handed down a somewhat specific, but also somewhat vague, as rules generally are in the legal world, set of standards for how to deal with when punitive damages are excessive. Now, this is kind of a tort case, so it's a little out of my field, but it's also interesting to me. Two things are interesting to me about this case. One, it's a 14th Amendment due process case, and those of you who have taken civil procedure with me know how interesting that stuff is to me. And second, it's a case about something that I begin all of my civil procedure classes with, and I see various cases who have been in my civil procedure class or are in it now. We talk about the difference between criminal law and civil law, or the difference between civil actions and criminal actions, and some of the things that we talk about to distinguish the two are very much at issue both in this case and more broadly in the circumstance of punitive damages. And I want to ask you all who are in it or have been in it some time to try to get your answers. But what two of the things that we identify in terms of what makes something civil as opposed to criminal is civil cases are about individuals seeking relief or sort of compensation for individual harm, whereas criminal cases are about sort of societal harm dealt with by society and responded to by society. Also, civil claims generally involve compensation, whereas criminal claims generally involve some sort of deterrence, retribution, different things like that. Many times, oftentimes rightly, a student, even that early in law school, the first couple days, will raise their hand and say, yeah, but what about punitive damages? Like, isn't that about punishment and isn't that? And I'm like, yeah, we'll talk about that. You can talk about that in your course class. Because that sort of breaks my nice clean distinction between the two. But the interesting thing is punitive damages are a combination of civil law principles and criminal law principles. And one of the things that all these cases are trying to deal with is how best to resolve that. Interestingly, none of these cases are about getting rid of punitive damages. At least, I'm sure
many people would like to do that, but none of these cases have gone so far as to suggest that that is a likelihood or even sort of part of the issue. What the issue is, when do punitive damages violate the 14th Amendment due process clause? The answer is they violate it when they're excessive. And the answer to when they're excessive is basically after State Farm, if they're more than 9 times the compensatory damage amount, if it's a relatively small compensatory damage amount. If it's a bigger compensatory damage amount, then the sort of the multiplier figure is going to be smaller. And secondly, when the punitive damage calculation is based in part or significantly on activities which had nothing to do with the plaintiff in the case. So punishing the defendant in the course of a civil action brought by a plaintiff for things that didn't relate directly to the plaintiff. And that was a big issue in the State Farm case, because a lot of the things that the plaintiff used to justify the punitive damages in that case was in Colorado were things, as unconscionable as they were to me reading them, didn't happen to be illegal in Colorado. They were illegal in like 45 other states, but they weren't illegal in Colorado. So the notion that Colorado plaintiffs could get punitive damage based on them caused problems from a due process standpoint in the Supreme Court. This case, quickly, 47-year smoker, died of lung cancer. He alleged that Philip Morris, in addition to selling cigarettes, had carried on a half-century program of trying to hide the harmful effects of cigarettes to cigarette smokers in the event or in the attempt to have them continue to smoke and develop new smokers, that there was a fraudulent and intentional attempt to hide this information. They won the case. They got $800,000 or over $800,000 in compensatory damages, and then got almost $80 million in punitive damages. The first appellate court in Colorado, this is a state case, reduced the punitive damages to $32 million. And then the Supreme Court of Oregon returned the original amount, and that was appealed to the Supreme Court. Initially, the Supreme Court sent the judgment back down to the Oregon Supreme Court saying, I guess you guys didn't read State Farm. This is more than 9 times the compensatory damage amount, so do it again. And much to, from my perspective, well, I don't know exactly how I feel about this case, but at least interestingly, the Oregon Supreme Court got it back and said, we're still going to affirm the amount of punitive damages based on our assessment. And basically what the Supreme Court of Oregon said was, given the standards laid out in State Farm, first, this 9 times figure the Supreme Court noted, and it's true, they said this wasn't supposed to be a specific or hard and fast number. You could sometimes go beyond it. And the key factor they focused on, there's basically 3 factors that courts after BMW are supposed to consider in looking at punitive damages. First is the degree of reprehensibility of the defendant's misconduct. Second is the disparity between the actual or potential harm suffered by the plaintiff and the punitive damages award. And third, the difference between the punitive damages award by the jury and the civil penalties authorized or imposed in comparable cases. And basically, the Supreme Court of Oregon focused on the first of these standards and said this, again, we construe all the facts in favor of the plaintiff, the party whose favor the jury rules. Doing so, there can be no dispute that Philip Morris's conduct was extraordinarily reprehensible. Philip Morris knew that smoking caused serious and sometimes fatal disease, but it nevertheless spread false or misleading information to suggest to the public that doubts remained about that issue. It deliberately did so to keep smokers smoking, knowing that it was putting the smokers' health and lives at risk, and continued to do so for nearly half a century. So that was their basis for the judgment, and Philip Morris is challenging this in the Supreme Court, basically saying they misread or misapplied State Farm to the case. For me, the interesting aspect, again, is the civil versus criminal sort of distinctions here. And the due process issue in civil cases is a very different issue than the due process in criminal cases. And Professors Robbins and Jones know far more about the types of sort of due process rules that apply in criminal cases. But I even know enough to know that two of the big distinctions between civil cases and criminal cases as it relates to due process are, first, the standard of proof that applies in civil cases as opposed to criminal cases. You can be found civilly liable with a much lower standard of proof. So if we're going to have principles for punishment in civil cases, in circumstances where the level of proof is much lower than they would justify punishment in criminal cases, that does create a significant potential due process issue. And the second is, in criminal cases, you can only be punished for the same crime once. I assume that's still true. I hope that's still true. But in civil cases, if you allow for punitive damages in an individual plaintiff's case, how many individual plaintiffs are there that could sue cigarette companies? And if each time the cigarette company is being punished with hundreds of millions of dollars in damages, then from the cigarette company's perspective, one thing they would argue is, even if it's okay to punish us in some sort of criminal-minded type sense in a civil case? Can you really do it 50 times or 100 times or 10,000 times or 100,000 times? When does that punishment start to be excessive, not just because of the lower level of proof, but because of the repetitive nature of these civil cases in different circumstances? So I wouldn't presume to predict what's going to happen, although generally the court seems to like corporate defendants more than they like non-corporate plaintiffs. But that's just far too generalized to be useful as a prediction. But it's very interesting to me to see how the court will take State Farm and maybe apply more specific standards. I get the sense the court might be annoyed that it feels like it tried to make these things go away with State Farm, and still these recalcitrant state courts are still giving people lots and lots of punitive damages. So I think they may come out with something much more specific and much more detailed, making it clear that they don't want punitive damages to go beyond a certain point. And they may say something interesting about due process as it relates to this very interesting and idiosyncratic combination civil criminal mechanism, which is punitive damages, which at its basis is a very compelling thing. So hopefully they'll say something interesting about it regardless of which way they do. I know that wasn't happening.
Thank you, Professor Nye. We saved the least controversial for last, abortion and affirmative action. And I'll try to do each in 5 minutes. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear two cases that are similar in each of the two areas. Let me start with the partial birth abortion case. In 2000, the Supreme Court struck down a state law, Nebraska law, in a case called Stenberg versus Carhart. By a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court ruled that Nebraska's ban on partial birth abortion was unconstitutional for a number of reasons. In particular, it did not include an exception that would allow this particular type of abortion when it was deemed necessary for the health of the mother. It had an exception for the life of the mother, but it didn't have an exception for the health of the mother. It was also considered overbroad and vague by the Supreme Court because it didn't adequately describe the medical procedure that it was prohibiting. So that was the 2000 decision on a state law, the Nebraska law. Congress, undaunted by just about anything, but particularly undaunted by the Supreme Court, Congress in 2003 passed the federal partial birth abortion ban. Congress says that it did a better job of defining the procedure that it was banning than the state of Nebraska did, and that therefore the law passed by Congress should be upheld. So far, no judge has agreed with Congress. Three district courts and three federal appeals courts have declared the federal law unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has now agreed to hear two of those cases. One is called Gonzalez versus Carhart, and the other is called Gonzalez versus Planned Parenthood. There are slight differences in the two cases. What Congress did here is quite fascinating, and it's a little bit hard to know how this will play out in the case. Congress basically said in a about 20 item list of findings at the beginning of the statute, Congress said, you know, when you, the Supreme Court, decided the Nebraska case in 2000, the judge in that case didn't have a very good factual record before him. But the Court of Appeals was required to accept the judge's factual record, and you, the Supreme Court, were, you know, relying on the Court of Appeals record, and so, in essence, doesn't say quite this cynically, but it's close. In essence, you, Supreme Court justices, didn't really know what you were talking about in 2000 when you decided the Nebraska case. You didn't have all the facts, you didn't really understand the medical procedures, the courts below hadn't helped you by developing a full record. So, we, the Congress, are going to take care of all of that. We're going to hold hearings. We're going to question doctors. We're going to make our own extensive findings about this partial birth abortion procedure. Well, let me give you an example. Finding number one says a moral, medical, and ethical consensus exists, and there's a lot of additional discussion describing the particular abortion procedure, which I'll omit at the moment. A medical, ethical, and legal, a moral, medical, and ethical consensus exists that this is a gruesome and inhumane procedure that is never medically necessary and should be prohibited. Finding number two, rather than being an abortion procedure that is embraced by the medical community, particularly among physicians who routinely perform other abortion procedures, this procedure is a disfavored procedure, in fact, poses serious risks to the long-term health of women, and again, should never be medically necessary. I don't want to re-argue the case, but let me just read you one sentence from the 2003 statement of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. They said, instead, legislators try to circumvent the court's requirements by issuing their own opinion to the nation's physicians and patients that such a procedure is never needed to protect a woman's health, notwithstanding opposing positions from the medical community. So what Congress has tried to do here is, in essence, say, we are declaring as legislative fact that this so-called partial birth procedure is never really necessary to preserve a woman's health. It might be necessary to save a woman's life, but it's never necessary in a non-life-threatening situation. And we've had hearings that establish that, and we're making these findings, and then comes the next step. Me Congress, you Tarzan, me Congress, you Supreme Court, whatever metaphor you want, you, the Supreme Court, have to rely on the facts found by Congress. Okay? You, the Supreme Court, should defer on the facts that Congress has found. So the argument, the way the argument in this case shapes up, two federal appeals courts rejected all of this, but the Justice Department is saying to the Supreme Court several things. First of all, there's no requirement, the Constitution does not require that there be an exception for the health of the pregnant woman. Period. Just not required. There's no reason why that should be in the case. Second argument is that the Supreme Court should defer to these findings by Congress and accept them as established fact. And then third argument essentially is, if in order to do all of that, you have a problem because of the 2000 Nebraska case, overrule. Get rid of it. It's not a precedent that's deserving of respect if it in fact conflicts with the federal statute. So that's the way the case comes to the Supreme Court. The Eighth Circuit in Gonzalez versus Carhart found the statute unconstitutional pretty much just because it lacked an exception for the preservation of a woman's health. The Ninth Circuit issued a broader opinion in which it said it's unconstitutional because it lacks the exception for the preservation of woman's health. It's also unconstitutional because of the same reason as the Nebraska case. It doesn't sufficiently narrow the procedure involved. Now, I don't want to go into a lengthy medical discussion on this. We want to get to the other cases. But simply put, there are a couple of different late-term abortion procedures. One of them is the most commonly used procedure called dilation and evacuation. The less commonly used procedure, that's a D&E. The less commonly used procedure is the dilation and extraction. Congress says it's only banning the dilation and extraction, but the Ninth Circuit said that's not the statute you wrote. The statute you wrote doesn't make clear that it's only banning the D and X procedure. It could also ban the D and E procedure. So now the Ninth Circuit says the ban is too broad. The ban would interfere with a woman's right to abortion. It would impose an undue burden. The Ninth Circuit also says that because you haven't properly defined the procedure you're talking about, this is a criminal statute. This would punish a doctor who violates this statute with 2 years in prison and fines. The Ninth Circuit says that doesn't fit with our criminal law. Criminal law is supposed to define precisely the crime so that doctors know whether they're committing it or not. you, Congress, haven't done that here. The last issue in the case is a little bit more technical one, and that is, if this statute is in fact unconstitutional for any of these reasons, what should a court do? Should a court save the statute by suggesting that there is a health of the mother exception, and therefore the statute can be applied that way? Or should the court say the entire statute is unconstitutional because that exception is lacking? The Ninth Circuit said it was essential to Congress that they not write a health of the mother exception into the statute. That's how Congress passed the law. That was a critical point to the people who voted for this statute. We can't issue an injunction that says, just kidding, we'll just read the health of the mother exception and therefore declare it constitutional. So that's the final issue that the Supreme Court has to decide. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito have not really made clear their positions in cases so far. Roberts did participate in the New Hampshire abortion case last term, but it was decided on fairly narrow ground. The key vote in the Nebraska case was Justice Kennedy, and Justice O'Connor's now departed. The Nebraska case was 5-4. Justice O'Connor voted to strike down the Nebraska law. Justice Kennedy, who had previously voted to uphold the right to abortion, said he thought the Nebraska law was okay. He dissented in 2000. So right now you have four justices, Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, who would almost certainly strike down the federal law. You have Scalia, Thomas, who would certainly uphold the federal law. You have Alito and Roberts that we're not sure about, but betting would be that they would probably uphold the federal law. And then the question is, does Justice Kennedy stick with his position in the Nebraska case, in which case the federal law would be upheld, or does Justice Kennedy say, well, maybe it's time to respect the Nebraska decision, in which case the court might strike down the Nebraska. Alright, let me move on quickly to the affirmative action case, and then we can try to talk more about these questions. The Supreme Court has also agreed to hear two cases that pose the question of what public schools, in one case high school, and in one case all the way K through 12 public schools, what use of race can public schools make in admissions process? One case is from Seattle, the other case is from Jefferson County, Kentucky, which is Louisville. In the Seattle case, basically Seattle decided on its own that it has had a series of plans over a period of years in which it basically was trying to achieve a diverse student body in its school and trying to make sure that the schools were not lopsided in their racial makeup. The latest version of the plan, which the Supreme Court has agreed to review, basically says that the school system should use race as a tiebreaker, among other things. There are other tiebreakers too, geographical preference, whether you have siblings in the school. What happens in Seattle is you can apply to go to any high school you want. Whether you get into that high school will be determined first by whether the school is oversubscribed. If it's not overcrowded, then this issue doesn't exist. There's no question. But half the high schools are overcrowded, and therefore they have to figure out how to admit people and how to turn people away. What they look at is, first, if you have a sibling in the school, you get a preference. Second, if you live close to the school, you may get a preference. But third, they basically are trying to make the schools in Seattle roughly reflect the makeup of the population of the entire high school population of Seattle, which is about 60% minority and 40% white. So one of the tiebreakers is if you would skew the balance one way or the other, that may help decide whether you're going to get into that school or not. A group of white parents sued and challenged that as violating the Equal Protection Clause. Federal District Court upheld the plan. The Ninth Circuit initially struck the plan down, but the Ninth Circuit then reheard the case en banc with 11 justices participating and upheld the plan by a vote of 7-4. This case and the next one I'm going to talk about very quickly and be done in about 3 minutes. This case and the next case turn in large part on how far the Supreme Court wants to extend its 2003 decisions in the Michigan affirmative action case. The court in 2003 decided the Grutter and Graff case. Grutter involved the Michigan Law School, and the court said that Michigan's plan of using race as one of a number of factors to try to generally achieve a diverse class was constitutional. Michigan wasn't using rigid numerical quotas, that its goal of trying to achieve diversity in the law school classroom was a legitimate interest. Okay. In the other case, in the Grass case involving the Michigan undergraduate system, the Supreme Court said that the University of Michigan plan there, which involved a very kind of rigid statistical formula in which race was accorded a certain percentage of the admission process, that was too rigid and was unconstitutional, even though diversity was still a valid goal. Seattle says we're trying to do the same thing. We're trying to achieve diversity in the classroom, got all kinds of long-term benefits to society, and we think we've done it in a narrow and reasonable way. The Ninth Circuit agreed, but the Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case. The other case comes from Louisville, Jefferson County, Kentucky. This is kind of the ultimate irony, I think. This is the prototype of the post-Brown versus Board of Education world. Louisville, from 1975 to 2000, was under a federal court desegregation order to do pretty much what it's now choosing to do voluntarily. Okay, you got that? For 25 years, they basically gerrymandered the school system to desegregate the schools to achieve racial diversity in their classrooms, and they did that because a judge said the Equal Protection Clause required that. In 2000, the judge said, okay, good job, you're done. You're no longer under court supervision, we're releasing you. But Louisville then voluntarily, the Board of Education, said, well, gee, we like the result. We think this is pretty good to have racial diversity in our classroom. We'd like to continue it. So they adopted a series of voluntary plans to try to preserve the racial makeup of the Louisville schools, which involve, again, a combination of factors weighing geography, access to special schools like magnet schools, but also the racial makeup of the schools. The population of those Jefferson County schools is about one-third black, two-thirds white, and the school board has set a goal of trying to have every school stay within 15% to 50% of that breakdown. So you want to try to achieve that goal within a fairly large margin of error. Federal district judge said Louisville had done a fine job of it and upheld the plan. The Sixth Circuit, which was deeply, deeply divided in Michigan cases, with judges actually accusing each other of wrongdoing back in the, 5 years ago, openly accusing each other of manipulating cases. Sixth Circuit, I think, obviously to avoid the same thing happening again, issued a one-paragraph unsigned affirmance of the district court order. So what the Supreme Court is reviewing here actually is the federal district judge's opinion. There really is no Sixth Circuit opinion. Both of these were upheld then as constitutional, and the Supreme Court has agreed to hear both appeals. Again, in the Michigan cases, the court was deeply divided, Justice O'Connor was the deciding vote. She voted to uphold the law school plan, but to strike down the undergraduate plan. She's gone. We have no track record with Chief Justice Roberts or Justice Alito on this issue, and so both of these are going to be very interesting cases as well. Let's open it up to questions. We're podcasting this, so if you do have a question, please come down to the mic. Good question. Congress actually answered that question too. In the middle of the findings of fact is the argument cleverly relying on some major 1960s civil rights decision by the Supreme Court. Congress says, just as in Katzenbach versus Morgan, which was a decision that upheld the Voting Rights Act of 1965, so Congress says in Katzenbach versus Morgan, the Supreme Court said it should be highly deferential to findings of fact by Congress, and you, the Supreme Court, have to use the same deference in this case. The problem is that clearly the Supreme Court, if it thinks that the findings of fact are false, presumably can find a way to say so. But the Supreme Court may not think the findings of fact are false.
And since Katzenbach, the Supreme Court has been much more active in rejecting congressional findings of fact in Americans with Disability Act cases and other circumstances, the Violence Against Women Act, and other circumstances where they felt that findings of Congress didn't deserve any particular deference. This is one of the major separation of powers results of what was then the record for. So it'll be interesting to see how they factor that into this.
And it's sort of one thing to say, you know, we the Congress believe there ought not to be such a procedure. We believe that it's harmful or we're opposed to it. It's another thing to essentially say, you know, we decided which witnesses were going to come testify at the hearing. We stacked the deck. And then on the basis of that, there's a medical consensus, even though there clearly is no medical consensus. I was at a conference this weekend talking about the new Supreme Court term, and somebody else at the conference, I don't want to take credit for the line, said what we're really talking about here is that the person in the gown with the mask on standing next to the OBGYN is going to be a lawyer advising the OBGYN in the middle of the procedure. You know, stop, go, don't do it, do it. The short answer is, if that is a valid defense, it's not clear from the statute that it is. So the first person that wants to assert that defense, you know, good luck, but it might be asserting that defense in the jail.
Essentially is the case. The court says if you were illegally detained in violation of your Fourth Amendment rights, that occurred the day the police came and got you. That's when the violation occurred, and you knew at that time all the facts you needed to know. I was arrested. It wasn't based on probable cause. Therefore, the 2 years should have run that day. It's impractical because he then went on to trial and litigated that issue and lost and was convicted. And then it wasn't until, you know, several years later that the court said, you know, you were actually right at the beginning. You were being a legal thing. Well, it happens. I mean, it's nothing, it's impractical, but there's nothing, prisoners can and do litigate civil matters and habeas matters while they're still in prison. The fact of the matter is the question becomes, do you expect a person before there's been an official declaration by the highest court in that jurisdiction saying, you're right, legally they should not have arrested you, do you expect them to proceed with a civil case just to keep the statute of limitations from tolling? And as a practical matter, that doesn't make a lot of sense. As a jurisprudential matter, it doesn't make a lot of sense. He would have lost, inevitably, as he did in the criminal case. It's okay, you're among friends. You can just...
Is there a test? Yes. It no longer involves administrative convenience or inconvenience. The 1989 case, Teague v. Lane, basically overruled the old test from Linkletter v. Walker. Linkletter considered basically the importance of the new constitutional right, and in a balancing process, the burden on the judicial process if they were to make this newly enacted right retroactive. And in Teague v. Lane, the court basically said, we don't expect that too many new rights will be made retroactive. We're thinking about watershed constitutional rights like the Gideon case, the right to counsel. Of course, there aren't too many cases as watershed as Gideon. The new test from Teague v. Lane is really very restrictive. It says, generally speaking, new rules of constitutional criminal procedure will not be made retroactive. And then we've had, as I said before, approximately 24 cases telling us what new rules are. And the court has said a new rule is a rule that is not dictated by precedent. Well, what's dictated by precedent? Obviously, it's a flexible term. But unless it's dictated by precedent, meaning it clearly follows from some previous case, it's a new rule and then it's not retroactive, unless it comes within one of the two exceptions, which the Supreme Court has never imposed. So basically, the burden on the lower courts is no longer considered. The burden on the state courts is no longer considered. If this case, which in effect gets to the retroactivity of the Blakely case, which deals with the sentencing guidelines, if that were to be made retroactive, it would affect at least 250,000 cases. Can the system handle it? Well, on the one hand, you might say, it probably couldn't handle it, therefore we ought to factor that in. On the other hand, you can argue, and this is the side that I would argue, it doesn't matter how many cases there are, there's an unconstitutionality here, let's just make it retroactive and create judgeships or expand the system, do what you have to do to deal with the problem. I think practically, they don't have to do it. Maybe it goes through their mind, but it's no longer part of the analytical process. They don't have to do it because of the definition of new rule. So many things just at that level are not going to be retroactive. You never have to get further down the reasoning process. Good question. Thanks. That's a really good question, and I think it's some of all of those, but it's mostly the fact that we have a terribly written statute. This is one of the poorest written statutes you would ever see, and the fact that the Supreme Court is not reaching out to give us any clarity. I mentioned that one of the cases this year, Lawrence v. Farda, has to do with the tolling provision regarding the one-year statute of limitations to get from state to federal court. The tolling provision in the 1996 statute is one sentence long. This is now the seventh case interpreting that one sentence. There are six words in that sentence, that have already had three cases just on six words. How many times does it take to get it right? How many times does it take to give a definitive interpretation? So I think it's a combination of a bad statute and a court that is really unwilling to give too much guidance here. They want this to pay out in the lower federal court. And they're not taking these cases until there's a clear split among the circuits, as there is in Wharton v. Boxing. In this Lawrence v. Florida case, there is a 9-1 split in the circuit. The only circuit that has gone the way of the prisoner was the Sixth Circuit. And the Sixth Circuit did it in a 6-5 decision. I think the Supreme Court thinks, well, okay, now we really need guidance. Well, we needed it 5 years ago, and we needed it 8 and 9 years ago as well.
He was part of the three justice group that wrote the probably most profound, longest discussion of stare decisis ever in the court's history in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, Kennedy, O'Connor, and Souter, that came up with the undue burden standard, but as part of that joint opinion, laid out a 4-part test for stare decisis. But there's not a lot of evidence that Kennedy has ever used that test since Casey. And in the Nebraska case in 2000, he basically said, he didn't really address it as something that the outcome of which was determined by Casey. In fact, he said the opposite. He said, I don't understand how O'Connor and Souter, who were on the same opinion with me and Casey, could think that this statute is decided the way it is by Casey. I differ with him totally. I think the statute doesn't impose an undue burden. It has nothing to redeem it, to strike it down. He doesn't, I don't think he's disrespectful of precedent. If you had to order the court in kind of rank, I would say Kennedy is just the higher end of justices who care about precedent, but nobody on the court thinks that precedent is binding. They all think that precedent is to the point that they have the right to change their minds to take a different view.
Professor Jones will take the first question, and Professor Romeo will take the second one.
Died Nathan, Chief Justice of the panel. with respect to the Fourth Amendment, I don't think there's really even sort of a growing consensus. I think there's relative unanimity that the Fourth Amendment protections are eroding. The you know, what the court considers unreasonable for searches and seizures, how the court defines searches and seizures. And in this case, I don't think they're trying at all to strengthen the Fourth Amendment. In effect, it's going to weaken the Fourth Amendment, and that is you won't be able to get a civil remedy for a Fourth Amendment violation if the court interprets the statute of limitations the way the lower court did. So in effect, it's going to be a situation where even if you manage to get something that is unreasonable and constitutes a search or a seizure and therefore falls within the scope of the Fourth Amendment, it still may, because of a statute of limitations interpretation, may not result in you being able to sue civilly to redress that violation. It's hard enough to get your actions or get the police officer's actions within the scope of the Fourth Amendment for criminal purposes. And then if you manage to do so, that is, they rely on an uncorroborated informant's tip, which is not enough for probable cause, and therefore they shouldn't arrest you. That's a heavy burden. You manage to establish all that, and then someone says, however, within 2 years of the date you were arrested, you had to proceed to sue civilly, or you cannot recover for that constitutional violation, even though it resulted in you being imprisoned wrongly for 8 years. It seems to be another chip away at the Fourth Amendment. It's not going to mean much if prisoners, before the court has ever declared that they've been wrongly convicted or wrongly arrested, have to initiate a civil action while they're still in prison. So it's probably, you know, part of the same decline in taking away the peace of the Fourth Amendment as mine. Apparently you've been directed to answer the Indian law question.
I actually think on the second question, on the Indian law question, the justices keep Indian law cases, to be honest. And I've heard some of them say that. They think it's like plain jello. It has no shape and there's no structure to it. And, they basically, I heard Justice Souter address the group one time and say that they basically make Indian law as they go along.
Similarly, I heard Justice Scalia say, you know, I don't really know much about this. This seems the Indian always wins. But he said that. When I was clerking on the D.C. Court of Appeals, he came to speak, and he said, you know, who knows about these cases? This seems like the Indian always wins.
So that may not be a principled answer, but I think it's, I think it's a practical answer. Both good points. The cases are, depending on how the court views the cases, they may be significantly more complicated than I made them out to be because I was rushing someone. I'm getting to the answer to your question in a slightly roundabout way. There are in any of these cases, in Grutter and Bratt and in these two cases, the two parts of the equal protection question. Is there a compelling government interest and is there narrow tailoring? The two lower courts, the majorities in the lower courts, thought that the compelling government interest part of it, namely trying to achieve diversity, was a slam dunk. They didn't think it was a hard question at all. And I mention that because, interestingly, the Solicitor General of the United States has filed amici briefs in both cases saying they don't fall under Grutter or Gratz in terms of diversity, that neither city was actually trying to achieve diversity in their schools, even though the lower courts seem to have thought that was a really easy issue and didn't spend a whole lot of time on it. So that's one way in which it's actually more complicated. The Supreme Court could, I suppose, say, we agree with the Solicitor General. They weren't really trying to achieve diversity. They were trying to achieve racial balance, which we prohibited in desegregation cases in the 1970s. And that racial balance is different than diversity, and go into a whole discussion of how and why. That's one possibility, I suppose. the Supreme Court could say we accept the diversity rationale and move on to the whether it's narrowly tailored or not, and then consider each plan separately as to whether they are. The dissenters in the Ninth Circuit, I think, actually rejected the whole thing. I don't think they accepted, my recollection is they didn't accept the diversity rationale or the narrow tailoring. They were harshest about the narrow tailoring. They thought this was really using race as a naked preference and, therefore always overruled. I think it is more, much more nuanced than I made it out to be the first time through. The fact that the court accepted cert in the two cases is generally presumed to not be good news for either of the cities. First of all, the court tends to reverse in a fairly high percentage of the cases in which it grants cert. But second of all, these issues were totally 100% squarely presented in a case involving the Lynn, Massachusetts school. Lynn is a suburb north of Boston. These issues were squarely presented in a case involving the Lynn school about a year ago. And the Supreme Court denied cert in that case. The First Circuit had upheld Lynn's plan, just as the Two Circuits did here. So there's no new circuit it's not that, oh, so all of a sudden there's a circuit conflict, and now it's time to take it. There's no circuit conflict with the Supreme Court granted the two cases. So, as Professor Lubber suggested in the question, it is kind of widely assumed, that it was the arrival of Roberts and Alito that changed the court's view about whether it wanted to hear the case. And that presumably means that the affirmative action plans are at least in for very significant scrutiny, if not in deep trouble. All right, thank you, everybody. See you next year.
For the eighth annual.